So my topic tonight, Adventism, Roots, Shoots, and Those in Cahoots. I'm going to be using the term Adventism in a way a little bit different than what you all are accustomed to. I'm using more of a historical perspective of where this whole thing started, which we'll get into in just a minute. A guy named William Miller, when he started his movement, they were all called Adventists, not just Seventh-day Adventists. So as I use the word Adventists and Adventism here tonight, I'm using it more generically to refer to many different groups, not just the Seventh-day Adventists. Mark Twain said, "A lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes." He had such a way with words, didn't he? I love this quote, and it is so true. False doctrine, false teaching seems to travel so much faster than the truth. The truth barely gets itself mobilized sometime, just only to find out that the lie has already been everywhere that it can possibly reach. And that's one thing that we see happening in the beginning of the Adventist movement, beginning with this gentleman here. This is William Miller. Most of you have heard of him. Most of the things I'll tell you about him, you might have even known before. But what I want to do is trace the movement that he started into many, many groups that sprung from him. He was born in 1782, grew up in Loehampton, New York. He never claimed to be a prophet. He didn't think that what he started was because of some divine revelation. So he wasn't a prophet. He didn't receive anything from God. But just taking his concordance and his Bible, looking through it, he came to the conclusion that Jesus was going to come sometime between 1843 and 1844. Several passages were important to him in his study. One of them, Daniel 8:14, "Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary would be cleansed." 2,300 days, he says these are prophetic years. And the clock starts, according to this gentleman, is the decree of Artaxerxes to rebuild the temple, which that is at 457 BC. So if you want to know when the sanctuary would be cleansed, all you have to do is do the math. 457 BC plus 2,300 years, well, that's 1843, and the sanctuary would be cleansed. So what does it mean that the sanctuary is going to be cleansed? Jesus is coming back. So this is an important thing for him and his system. Another one that seems to pop up a lot is the parable of the 10 virgins. And we're not going to read through it, but just to give it the quick summary here, there's going to be this marriage. 10 virgins go out to meet the bridegroom, but the bridegroom tarried. Very important buzzword in Millerism circles. The bridegroom tarries. Something delays him a little bit. So they all fall asleep. And at midnight, there's this midnight cry, "Behold the bridegroom!" Another important buzzword in Millerism, the midnight cry. This becomes a timeline in their understanding of how end times are supposed to work out. There's going to be a tarrying time. There's going to be a midnight cry. After the midnight cry, there's five foolish virgins. We ran out of oil. So they had to run and get some oil for their lamps. Now, while they were gone, the bridegroom comes, shows up, finds the five virgins that are ready, brings them into the banquet. And number nine here says, when the foolish came, the door was shut. They couldn't get into the banquet. This becomes another important thing as they struggle to figure out, is the door shut? What does it mean that the door is shut in this timeline of this, what they call to be a prophecy? I don't think it's a prophecy at all, but to them, this is a prophecy. So Miller's prediction of the end turns out to be the midnight cry for many of them. They believe he is given the midnight cry. The bridegroom is coming soon. In 1832, he submits his ideas into this paper called the Vermont Telegraph, a Baptist newspaper. And it's like a shot heard around the world, or the lie zooming around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes. Miller writes, "I begin to be flooded with letters of inquiry respecting my views, and visitors flock to converse with me on the subject. Instantly, He's famous. These ideas that he's publishing, people want to know more. Jesus is coming back. In 1834, he's unable to comply with all the questions, with all the people trying to get him to come and speak, that he publishes a synopsis of his teachings into a 64-page tract. And if you've seen writing back then and how small the letters are, just the amount of information in a 64-page tract was just phenomenal. Many people get on board with this. They don't see him necessarily as a prophet, but he's teaching this angle on prophecy that they've never heard before, and they're excited about it. And I'm going to call what happens here a one-issue movement. The one issue is Jesus is coming back. What I mean by that is everything that keeps Christians in different churches all of a sudden became not important. Presbyterians, Baptists, Methodists, people involved in the Campbellite movement, people who would normally not associate with each other, all of a sudden those barriers are broken down because of this one movement, this one issue in the movement. Jesus is coming. Jesus is coming. It's coming. It's coming soon. And everybody's getting excited about this. These things that separated them before are no longer. And they all start to coalesce around his teachings and coming up with their own way of explaining it, coming up with their own verses. William Miller's not the only one that has teachings on this subject. Many others start to jump in the mix as well, supporting Miller and backing it up with new doctrinal ways of looking at new biblical passages. Joshua Himes, in 1840... he actually meets Miller earlier in 1838, and he, in 1842, starts to publishing some of Miller's works. He's an experienced publisher and really can help get the words out. He has a magazine called Signs of the Times. But what's important about Joshua Himes is he's part of a group called the Christian Connection. The Christian Connection, they're Arians. In other words, they don't believe that Jesus is God. He's possibly a very powerful being, something that God created in the beginning, but he is not God himself. So they're Arians, and also he believes in conditional immortality. So he's part of a group that definitely a lot of these groups would never associate with, the Baptists, the Methodists. They wouldn't have anything to do with this, but all of a sudden, that's not important. Jesus is coming. This one issue takes over their lives, takes over their thinking, takes over everything of their lives, of what they're focused on. Jesus is coming. Now, as everybody that's getting excited about this, imagine yourself, if you were convinced Jesus is coming really soon in the timeline, 1842, okay, Jesus is supposed to come back 1843-ish, what would you be doing? You'd be telling everybody you could find, right? In your churches, outside of your churches, in the workplace. Pretty soon, people are getting pretty annoyed at these Adventists or Millerites or whatever we want to call them at this point, because they're constantly telling them the end is coming. It's just going to be here in a few years. And after a while, these people that are getting tired of them are starting to kick them out of their churches. Some of the newspaper articles that are written against the followers of William Miller, they're mean. Back in those days, boy, you wouldn't see newspaper articles written saying the harsh, judgmental words that they would say in the newspapers of those days. And the followers of this movement, they're getting pretty tired of it. They're getting beat up in the press. They're getting beat up in their homes. They're getting beat up everywhere they are. And so they start to tell everybody, get out of Babylon. Babylon is the system of the world. The people who are against the true movement of God, the people who recognize the end is coming, we are the true ones. You need to follow us and be ready for Jesus. They become pacifists. It's a very important thing in Miller's followers, pacifism. Whenever you have a group that's heavily persecuted, often they become pacifists because they're being treated brutally and harshly. They react by saying, you're not supposed to act like this. And that's where they went with this. So William Miller never gave an exact date for the end. He said it's going to be sometime between March 21st, 1843, and March 21st, 1844. This is according to the Jewish calendar. So 1843 comes along, nothing happens. But the date in 1844 comes along, nothing happens then either. So you would wonder, well, how come March 22nd, 1844? We still have people following these ideas. It's interesting, as I first did my research on this several years ago, and I'm puzzled over this, how this movement kept going after the dates didn't pass. It dawned on me, reading their stuff and thinking about their mindset, the gospel changed in their minds. They belonged to good Bible-believing churches at first, but then after they jumped into the stream of William Miller and joined this one issue, the gospel was no longer Jesus died for your sins, you need to have faith and trust in him. The one issue was Jesus is coming back, pack your bags. Who got into the wedding feast in the parable we looked at? The virgins that were ready. If you want to be saved, you have to be ready. All these other things, they don't matter. So people who are following William Miller and agreeing with his teachings, on the morning of March 22nd, they're still believing these things. The gospel's still true. We're not really sure when he's coming. We're not really sure what happened. But somehow the gospel's still true. They can't come to grips and admit that, okay, maybe we don't know what the gospel is, but for them, it becomes the gospel. Jesus is coming. Pack your bags. William Miller tries to stay strong. After this, in a letter on March 25th, 1844, he says that he still believes that the end is near. At this point, they believe they're in the tarrying time. Okay? At this point, they're in the tarrying time of the 10 virgin parable. He's delayed. The bridegroom is delayed. He was supposed to be here. When is it going to be? Well, August 1844, there's a camp meeting in New Hampshire. This guy here, Samuel Snow, I said August, October 22nd. Okay, one of my notes said August. Is it August or October? October. Okay, my note was wrong. My PowerPoint is right. October 22nd, 1844, in this camp meeting, Samuel Snow gives this message. It becomes known as the seventh month message or the true midnight cry. See? Coming back to that 10 virgin parable. The word of his date spreads like wildfire. October 8:22 is going to be the date of the end. Jesus didn't return. And of course, we know what happens. They call this the great disappointment. Jesus was supposed to come. It didn't happen. People were shocked, dismayed, weeping, falling apart. They banked everything on this date and nothing happens. But now the confusion starts. See, everybody jumped into this one-stream movement. All of a sudden, they wake up and they're looking around. They still believe this new gospel. The end is Jesus is coming, pack your bags. But now the problem is, wait a minute. I don't agree with that guy. I think they're wrong too. So people have to start wrestling with all these other things that separate us. And they start moving off into many different directions. From here, what I want to do is trace the development of Miller's movement into two different ways, the Sunday Adventists and the Sabbatarian Adventists. Now, not to discourage you, but if you're trying to take notes, this is basically a breakdown of what I'm going to try to do. It explodes at this point as people are trying to figure out different doctrinal things, wrestling with different parts of where they fall on different prophecies. Though these groups break off into a myriad of directions, there's some common themes that run through many of these Adventist groups. And I list eight of them here. First of all, they're Advent-focused. They're still looking for the end. Jesus is coming, pack your bags. So that's obviously a hallmark of Adventist groups. In a book by Edmund Gruss, he lists all these dates as different dates that were predicted for Jesus to be coming back. And these are just dates that were given in the 1800s. There's even more that continue to be predicted into the 1900s, and even one that I'm going to tell you about later that's predicted for just a few weeks from now. So Adventists are still trying to find when is Jesus coming. The second one I have here, Arianism. Now, of these eight characteristics that I see that flows throughout Adventism, not all of the groups necessarily hold to all of these and not necessarily all of the time. Not all of them become Arians. Some of them might flip-flop or waffle on it throughout time. Some of them might even stop being Advent. But these are just general characteristics that we see emerge out of Miller's movement. Conditional immortality and merit for salvation. These two kind of go hand in hand. So you're not going to exist forever. It's conditional. And that also plays into merit for salvation. There's something you have to do in order to become immortal. Well, first of all, you've got to believe in the Advent. You have to believe in Jesus is coming. Pack your bags. That's part of it. But there's other things you need to do as well. Some of them might just have a few rules. Others might say you have to do everything that God has commanded in order to be okay and receive immortality. Pacifism, huge one also with the Millerites. If you're one of the new Adventists and you start to follow a bunch of other people that are Adventists and they start to back off from pacifism, they split and break off really quick on this. And we're going to see many groups do this. The last three kind of fit together too. Flee Babylon, anti-organization, and published magazines. Flee Babylon, that comes from the persecution that they're receiving from everyone. You know, quit telling us about this. These poor folks, after the great disappointment, all of the jeers and all of the persecution they still were receiving, they were against organization. Flee Babylon, get out of all these organized churches, organized religion. So they're anti-organization. However, there's going to be some external forces that are going to force them into organization. They don't want to. It's part of their heritage to not be. But if they don't, they're going to have to give up other things. We'll see. Published magazines. So if you're not going to start an organization, you have to have a way to have your group grow and cohere somehow. How are you going to have fellowship if it's not in a church? How are people going to stay connected? And it was through publication of magazines. I have a list of some of the magazines here. I'll just read you off the list. I just love the names that they come up with some of their magazines. The Present Truth, you might have heard of that. But reading on, the present truth of the apocalypse, the present truth and herald of Christ's kingdom, the Bible standard and herald of Christ's kingdom, herald of the coming kingdom and age to come, herald of the morning, Advent herald, Messiah's herald, herald of the coming one, herald of Christ's kingdom, herald of the epiphany, and of course, the old corn gems. These are just some of the magazines that explode out of Millerism's movement. These magazines help people stay together. Now, let's start looking at some of the offshoots of the Adventists. First of all, looking at the Sunday folks. And to begin with, even before I get into some of the groups, right after 1844, a year later, there was a conference in Albany, New York. 61 delegates from some of the bigger names from Millerites' teaching got together to discuss where they're going to go from there, and to discuss some of the controversial things. Some things had to be kind of figured out. One of the things that they had to wrestle with is the idea of the shut door. If the door is shut, what does that mean? Usually, to most of them, that meant if the door is shut, then nobody else can be saved. I read stories of some people who tried to join some Adventist groups, and they were told, no, the door's shut. You can't be saved, so you can't join us. At the Albany Conference, and what's difficult about doing research on this kind of project for me is that you hear so many different voices saying different things. It's hard to narrow down exactly what it was, but it seems like all of the 61 delegates of the Albany Conference believed that the door was still open. So now if the door is open, that's going to really change how you live out your newfound religion. Because if the door is shut, you don't have to do any evangelism or proselytism. But if the door is open, that opens the way for you to travel around, teach people, and that kind of thing. So, I should throw in there, from the Albany Conference, they rejected Sabbatarianism. So this is just basically the Sunday Adventists who went to the Albany Conference. They thought that the Sabbatarians were fanatics. So they weren't invited, and they didn't participate in it. Now, I'm open to the possibility maybe some people went that later became Sabbatarians, but at this point, it seems like Sabbatarians were not there. They were the fanatics. One thing I read said, the Seventh-day Sabbath was rejected by the delegates at the Albany Conference, who passed a resolution to have no fellowship with Jewish fables and commandments of men that turn from the truth. So, Sunday Adventists, they saw them as the Sabbatarians, as somebody not to get on board with. Dr. John Thomas came from Britain and originally got involved in the Campbellite movement. In 1843, he met William Miller, liked his ideas, left Campbellism, and jumped into Miller's streams. After the Great Disappointment, he started traveling around New York in 1846 and started teaching, and a lot of people liked what he had to say. He started to read his magazine, if I have it written here, The Hope of Israel. It was, I guess, books written from his lectures. There were Arians, didn't believe Jesus is God. They didn't believe Satan is real either. Satan is more of like illustrative of the allurements of this world. The Christadelphians emerged from his talks. I will list the date of 1865, is it there, as when they came together as a group. And the reason why they incorporated together as a group is because a little thing called a war was going on. And these people are pacifists. If you're a pacifist and you don't want to participate in a war, you have to be identified with a legitimate religious system that's pacifist. So all these people that are agreeing pacifism is wrong and anti-organization are stuck into a problem. This happens to many groups, and you'll see a lot of the dates for the beginning of these groups that I'm going to show you start around the 1860s, because they need to be able to show the government, we're part of a group that says no war. And that's what happens with them. After the Great Disappointment, many of the groups traveling around or living in New York and other parts of the East that agreed with a lot of their ideas, they started to notice each other's publications and magazines and started to come together in that way. Some of these folks are called the Age to Come Movement, Restitutionists, Soul Sleepers, and Judaizers. In 1869, they attempted to join. This group had a really hard time joining and falling apart and moving back and forth. But in 1869, we call this the Church of God General Conference of the Abrahamic Faith. A few different key leaders in there. I won't go into the name of their name right then, but this is one of their early names. They had a general conference, the first one that seemed to work in 1921. So they kind of had a long history of going back and forth and trying to cohere as a group. They denied the Trinity. They started the Atlanta Bible College. Now, one of the early key figures in the Church of God General Conference, is this guy, Benjamin Wilson. Benjamin Wilson corresponded back and forth with John Thomas quite a bit early on. He was also a former Campbellite. Benjamin Wilson, one thing that you might have heard of, the emphatic diaglot, the interlinear translation of the Greek, where they use the word Jehovah in there. Benjamin Wilson is the translator of this. He is one of the key leaders that starts the Church of God General Conference, but he also started a bunch of other churches in Cleveland called, by a different name, Church of the Blessed Hope. When Church of God General Conference started to attempt to be one organization, the Church of the Blessed Hope didn't really care for some of the directions they were going, so they went off on their own. Not necessarily a fight or disagreement, but more of just a general parting of ways. Like, okay, we're not agreeing with you guys, we're going our way. So Church of the Blessed Hope used to be Church of God Abrahamic Faith, but then they started their own organization based on the name that they came up with. I don't have a picture for Jonathan Cummings, so you just have to look at his name. Jonathan Cummings was one of Miller's associates. He believed that William Miller was 10 years off. He thought the date for Christ's coming was going to be in 1854. Some of his followers didn't like the idea that he came up with the date. Others thought this was a good idea. Those that stayed with him, with his date setting, they became the Advent Christian Church in 1860. These folks were Trinitarian, believing in conditional immortality. In 2006, they had just over 25,000 members, 293 churches in the United States, and they claim that throughout the world, there's 100,000 churches, or 100,000 members internationally in 35 different countries. Now, another approach to Miller's failed prediction came with this group here, the Life and Advent Union. They were called the Spiritualizers. They believe that Jesus Christ actually did return in 1844. But he came back spiritually instead. So they thought William Miller was right, but the door's still open, but Jesus is back invisibly. And the millennium began on that date. Well, in 1964, they merged with the Advent Christian Church. I don't know if they changed their ideas on the spiritual return of Jesus or how exactly that played in, but they merged and are no more as a separate group. George Storrs was the editor for the Advent Christian Church when it first started, or for the Life and Advent Union when it first started. Okay, I'm going to throw him up and just a few other guys here. George Stetson, part of Advent Christian Church, who's a pastor for Advent Christian Church in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Jonas Wendell, also part of the Advent Christian Church. These three guys had a lot of influence on this gentleman here you might recognize. This is Charles Taze Russell. I know some of you are thinking, that's Jim Valentine, right? No. Charles Taze Russell, the founder of the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, what we know as the Jehovah's Witnesses today. Let me just read a little bit about these different fellows. First of all, he sees Jonas Wendell preaching, some of the things Jonas Wendell was into. He wrote a book in 1870 called Present Truth or Meat in Due Season. These are buzzwords that float around with the Jehovah's Witnesses today. Meat in due season, present truth. He once held that 1850 was going to be the second advent, and then he started teaching that 1873 was going to be the time for Jesus' invisible presence. As you can see in the picture, he's got that on his podium. George Storrs had some interesting teachings. He said Passover should be celebrated only once a year. Same thing with the Jehovah's Witnesses now. Christ's ransom sacrifice provides for restitution of mankind to a paradise earth. Where did Charles Taze Russell come up with some of these ideas? Well, he didn't come up with them on his own. He had people teach him. He also taught that the Great Pyramids of Egypt corroborates the Bible. Charles Taze Russell did that also. Now, the Watchtower kind of wants to cover that up, but that is in early Watchtower history. That's what Charles Taze Russell taught. So Russell is intrigued by all this, but he's not quite convinced. So he just washes his hands to it, like, okay, this is really good, this is great, this is better than where he was. He was Presbyterian. He didn't like the idea of people going to hell for eternity, so he kind of distanced himself from this. Then he meets someone else. Whoops. A guy named Nelson Barber. Nelson Barber is an independent Adventist. He's not part of any organized group at this point. Charles Taze Russell meets him, and here's his spin on it, and finally goes into it, hook, line, and sinker. Russell sells all of his clothing stores. That was for $300,000, which is an equivalent to $7 million today. So he sold his clothing stores and invests into Nelson Barber's work. This was in 1876. According to Nelson Barber, Jesus' invisible presence started in 1874, and the bride would be translated. In other words, the end is going to happen in 1876. So when Charles Taze Russell jumps into Nelson Barber's stream, he believes in 2 years the end is going to be there. So that's why he sold his clothing stores. It wasn't just that wow, this is great, this is the truth, I want to get in here and teach too. He thought the end was going to happen in 2 years. Jesus is coming, pack your bags. He packed up his clothing stores. 1878 came, nothing happened. So Charles Taze Russell and Nelson Barber, they part ways over a number of issues. Charles Taze Russell starts his own organization. In 1979, he starts his magazine, Zion's Watchtower and Heralds of Christ's Presence, forerunner of today's Watchtower magazine. And in 1881, Zion's Watchtower Tract Society. And in 1884, they were incorporated. Now, in the beginning, they're called Bible students, Millennial Dawn people, and Watchtower people. Some people nicknamed them Russellites and Rutherfordites. Rutherfordites from the second leader of the organization, Judge Rutherford. So they're called Bible students, though, usually. In 1831, though, they came up with the name the Jehovah's Witnesses, what we know of them today. I'm not going to go through any more of the splinters from the Jehovah's Witnesses. As you can see, there's a whole bunch, just to throw them up on the screen. The Watchtower Bible and Tract Society splinter for many different reasons over the years, over issues of pacifism, of organization, of different change doctrines, for many different things. If you want to hear a breakdown on it, I have my teaching on YouTube that I did at a former Jehovah's Witness conference a number of years ago. If you go to YouTube, just do a search for... You have to put my name in it, or you find somebody else's website I found. But if you put my name, Root Shoots Cahoots, it comes up to this teaching. You can see how the Jehovah's Witnesses break down all the way through here. So this is the Sunday Adventists, as I said. Let's don't forget there's a whole other half to this movement, the Sabbatarians. First, let's think about how did the issue of the Sabbath jump into Miller's stream? A few different people we can see that got Sabbatarianism into the William Miller's movement, but this is commonly the way it's explained as one of the major ways that the movement got going with the idea of Sabbatarianism. This guy named Fred Wheeler, he's a Methodist Episcopal minister. He becomes a Millerite in 1842. A couple of years later, in 1844, during a communion service, he says, "Only those who keep all of God's commandments can participate in communion." Do people listen to themselves? I mean, did anybody participate? I want to see who participated in communion at Fred Wheeler's church there. But he said that. Now, he had a visitor to his church that day. Her name was Rachel Oaks. Rachel Oaks is a Seventh-day Baptist. So she hears this guy say, "You have to keep all of God's commandments." She goes up to him after the church service and she asks him, "What about the Sabbath?" And he says, "Excuse me? Well, you say we have to keep all of God's commandments. What about the one about observing the Sabbath?" So Fred Wheeler sits back, does his homework, looks at it, and realizes, "Oh, wow. We got to keep the Sabbath, don't we?" After that, he convinces this guy, Thomas Preble, that you have to keep the Sabbath. And in 1845, Preble starts to publish these ideas about the Sabbath and really gets the Sabbath movement into the Miller stream. Even though it's after the Great Disappointment, this really runs through a lot of people who are following William Miller's teachings. So let's look at some of these groups here. The Sabbatarian Adventists, a lot of them believed in the shut door. Not all of them, you'll see, but a lot of them believe that the door is shut. This first group I'm going to show you that you've heard a few things about, they had an interesting way of explaining about this shut door. Because, see, if you believed in the shut door, at some point you're going to have to open it. Because, you know, it's long past 1844 and nothing has happened, so we've got to say the door must have opened, or maybe we were totally wrong about the door. But this group, and you heard, I almost called him the Apostle Paul Cardin earlier, kind of went through this story already. Plus, many of you probably know this much better than I do. But you know this guy named Hiram Edson. Man, everything is a tongue twister this morning, or this evening. I don't even know what time it is. Hiram Edson has this vision, walking through his cornfield, that Jesus goes into another compartment in heaven in order to start this new phase of work. Now, in the beginning, this was not supposed to be something that was going to help answer the shut door issue, but later they realize how it can help them out. But he has this vision. This guy here, Joseph Bates, learns of it. He becomes convinced of it. He says that this is superior to any kind of thing that he's seen as far as an explanation of what happened in 1844. Because they don't want to admit that nothing happened. They believe something happened. What was it? Ha! Now we've got it. Jesus started this new work of ministry in the heavenly sanctuary. Introduces the subject to Ellen White, who then endorses this in her vision. And she says that this is the true light. So they now have a way of understanding what happened in 1844. Later, they use this whole thing to explain the shut door. They say, well, see, yeah, in 1844, the door was shut. And later they have to realize, okay, they need to let people in. There's a few different reasons why they need to start opening the door. First of all, what about children of the Adventists and other things? If you want to learn more detail about the Seventh-day Adventists and how they work through the shut door theory, look at Del Ratzliff's book on the back, Cultic Doctrine. There's a whole chapter dealing with it, and he details it through very well. But they have to start opening the door somehow, so they come up with the idea that, okay, yeah, the door was shut in 1844 in the Great Disappointment, but he shut one door and opened another one. He shut the door to one phase of his work, and now he opened another door. So they were able to deal with it that way. 1863, we have for the date of the incorporation of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. But things weren't always happy and cohering in the early fledgling movement of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. As you can see, there's many more lines to go through here. Starting around in 1853 in Jackson, Michigan, there were a couple of guys, Russell and Case, who were pioneers in Adventism all the way back to 1844. They agreed the great disappointment. They agreed all the things that Ellen White and everybody else was saying. They were on board with all this. However, Ellen White got upset with them because of the way they handled some issue and had some kind of a testimony against her. Or she had a testimony against them, which totally floored them. And they started to see her for what they really believe her to be now, not the Lord's messenger. And they started their own newspaper called The Messenger of Truth in 1853. The Whites called them the Messenger Party, which it's hard to say exactly what their influence was, how many people started to believe them and follow them, but just looking at some of the reactions in the Present Truth in the Whites newspaper, their paper, shows that they were pretty upset about the Messenger Party, so maybe they're having a pretty good influence on them. There's no copies of the Messenger Party of their newspaper, so we don't know exactly if there's also some doctrinal issues or what all that they worked over. If you look at Seventh-day Adventist history from the Seventh-day Adventists, they would have you think that all Sabbatarians that came out of William Miller's movement all joined the Seventh-day Adventist Church, except for maybe a few nut jobs. Besides that, everybody else became Seventh-day Adventists, and that's just not true. Some people who moved off and started churches and their own magazines, they didn't even know about her at first. And so when Ellen and James White would travel around to help their movement cohere, some of the Sabbatarians would look at them like, who are you and why should we follow you? They're not all on board with them. So they would, the Whites would pass them all off as like, okay, there's something wrong with you. You guys are fanatics for some reason because you're not joining us. There's disagreements with the Whites and what they started over issues of what happened on 1844. Not all Sabbatarian Adventists believed in the investigative judgment. That was unique to the Whites and what they were doing. Issues of food, marriage, and the shut door divided a lot of the Sabbatarian Adventists. This guy here, Gilbert Cranmer, in the beginning, he was swimming in the streams of the Seventh-day Adventists before they incorporated. But in the beginning, accepting Ellen White's visions were never a test of fellowship. But they started to become that way, and seems like it might have become that way because of him. He was at some churches and doing some preaching, and some guy came up to him and said, so, do you believe that the door is shut? Gilbert Cranmer says, no, actually, I don't believe the door is shut. And the guy says, well, I have proof that the door is shut. Okay, show me your proof. I want to see it. The guy pulls out a book by Ellen White and shows him the proof. Gilbert Cranmer's like, well, let's see. Let me read the way he said it. Perhaps Mrs. White's visions are proof to you, but they're not to me. And people were shocked. You don't agree with Ellen White? Oh, no. So they get upset. The news gets to the Whites, and they start to get very nervous about, or I don't know if they're nervous, but they're not very happy with Gilbert Cranmer. Later, he comes to them to get some kind of license to preach, which really befuddles me why that he was doing that. But he goes to them to get some kind of license to preach. James White says, no, you're not going to get licensed to preach because we don't like you, or you're not accepting of Ellen White's visions. So he says, all right, fine. I don't need you. He goes throughout Michigan. This guy obviously doesn't believe in a shut door because he's out starting churches. Over 10 churches he founds. Calls them the Church of Christ. 1863, these churches in Michigan start to form their own general conference. 1863 here, the Church of Christ in Michigan. Another guy, Merritt E. Cornell, he starts to evangelize in Iowa and starts to get many churches who form together Church of Jesus Christ in Iowa. And as he's doing this, he starts to introduce the visions of Ellen White. I don't know if he didn't know about her in the beginning, or maybe he just learned and then decided to start telling some of his churches that he started about her, and they didn't want anything to do with him. Some of them agreed. Others of them didn't necessarily jump on board. In 1874, we have the Sabbatarian Adventist Conference of Missouri is organized. In 1875, they changed their name to the Church of God. In 1881, they had a conference in which 1,200 up to maybe 1,500 members attended, which in those days, that's a lot of people. So they've got some good numbers growing here. All these three conferences join in 1884 into what we have today is the Church of God Seventh Day. So it's interesting, the Sunday Adventists, they have a Church of God of the Abrahamic faith. The Sabbatarians have their Church of God Seventh Day. Now, the name is not actually selected and settled on until 1923. Churches and individuals had a great liberty in belief. They had 24 articles of common belief, but still they had great diversity in their ability to believe different things. In 2001, there were 200 churches in the United States with 125,000 members worldwide. They seem to reject the Trinity. That's another difficult thing with this research is trying to nail down some of these groups and what they believe. Sometimes they're not really upfront with the doctrinal statement. But they seem to reject the Trinity, conditional immortality. They said saving faith includes repentance, which activates obedience and good works through love. So if you have good faith, then it will activate your obedience. Now, in 1920 through 1940, there was big controversies within the Church of God Seventh Day. Issues over British Israelism and feast days and some other issues. Who becomes a big leader in the Church of God Seventh Day, moves off on his own, is this guy, Herbert W. Armstrong. In 1931, he becomes a minister in the Church of God Seventh Day. 1933, he starts his Radio Church of God and later becomes starts the Worldwide Church of God. 1950, starts the World Tomorrow program television show. He believes in British Israelism, one of the controversies that was going on in the time of the Church of God Seventh Day. This is the idea that there are 10 lost tribes of Israel in the Bible, and we figured out who they are. They're the British, which then are us in the United States as well, because we migrated from there. So we are the true Jews of the Bible, they would teach. Now, Herbert W. Armstrong, after he died, Joseph Tkach Sr., when he took over the organization, started taking a re-look at some of their doctrines and teachings and started to realize they're off. They're looking at doctrines about the Holy Spirit and many other things, and ultimately became an evangelical denomination. Unprecedented, blew the minds of everybody when their leadership started contacting organizations like CFAR and Watchman Fellowship and other groups to ask for help. How do we transform this cult into something else? Herbert W. Armstrong rejected the Trinity. How are they going to infuse this back in? Well, as they tried to transform the organization, you can imagine the splinterings that happened from there. One estimate I read was there's like 300 different groups that claim that they are the continuation of what Herbert W. Armstrong taught. I mean, you could fill all kinds of PowerPoints with what happened after his organization changed. But another one of the controversies that was going on around this time was over the name of God. Some of the very prominent Church of God Seventh-day people like Andrew Duggar and C.O. Dodd started asking some questions. They said, well, what name are we supposed to baptize in? Now, it sounds a little similar to what Paul was talking about earlier, but they don't become one as Pentecostals. They start what we call the sacred name movement. Many of the churches that you see that use the name Yahweh or some kind of form of YHVH has their roots, a lot of them, some way back into the Adventism stream. Now, I just list a bunch of different groups here, assemblies of YHVH. Some of these, they say you have to know the name of God, but they recognize nobody knows the name of God. So it becomes very interesting as they start to wrestle, and it makes many of them split from each other as they disagree of how God's name is really supposed to be spelled, how is it supposed to be pronounced. So we have many different groups. We got 1969 Assemblies of God with Jacob O'Meyer. We have Assembly of Yahweh with L.D. Snow, many different groups in the sacred name movement. And as you can see, we've got some more to jump here up here. Let me move on. In 1924 through 28, we had the True and Free Seventh-day Adventist Church. They believe that because the Seventh-day Adventist Church General Conference did not disfellowship those who bore arms in World War I, they broke away from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. They said that the General Conference had officially compromised its principles and became Babylon, and this group saw themselves as the remnant of the remnant. Okay, they were in Russia. This other group here, the Reform Movement, Seventh-day Adventist Reform Movement, I'm very curious if these two groups somehow had some connection. In the little time I had researching these, I didn't see any connection. If any of you know if there's a connection between them, I'd love to know, because they had the same issues in different countries. So this one here in 1925, the Seventh-day Adventist Church said that it was acceptable for Adventists to take part in war. What are one of the big characteristics of the Millerites? Pacifism. You start saying it's okay to participate in war, you start to create splinters, and that's what happens. Those who opposed the Seventh-day Adventist Church, they were disfellowshipped. After the war, the Seventh-day Adventist leaders came to admonish some of the European leaders for what happened. That didn't work out too well. And then the group organized into 1925, incorporated here into 1949. 2005, Seventh-day Adventist Church tried to apologize for their participation in support of the Nazi activities during the war, but it did not bring the kind of fellowship they were hoping for. In 1930 time frame, we have Florence and Victor Hutev, the Bulgarian immigrants that come into the United States, joined the Seventh-day Adventist Church, but shortly, Victor is teaching things that they're uncomfortable with. I won't get into what some of his teachings were. He published these books, The Shepherd's Rod, Volume 1 and 2. Some of them started to call them the Shepherd's Rod Seventh-day Adventists. In 1930, came up with the name the Davidian Seventh-day Adventists. So 1935, their headquarters are moved to Mount Carmel, Texas, just outside of Waco. So if you've been around for a while, you know where this is going, right? In 1937, they were called the General Association of the Shepherd's Rod Seventh-day Adventists, and then they became the Davidian Seventh-day Adventists. Ben dies, and Florence Hutev takes over the leadership, and she claims that the world would end in 1959. She's an Adventist, so she's looking for the end. When 1959 doesn't happen, the group splinters. A lot of the group goes back to the Seventh-day Adventist Church, but many followed this next couple here, Lois and Ben Rodden. Ben claimed that 1960 is the real date. 59 didn't work out, it's next year. You'd think he'd give himself a little more cushion than that, right? 1960 was supposed to be the real date, and that God chose him, not Florence, to lead the group. They come up with their name now, 1959, the Branch Davidian Seventh-day Adventist Church. Rodden introduced feast days, Passover, Pentecost, Day of Atonement, and Feast of Tabernacles. Ben Rodden dies in 1978. I don't know what happened between 1960 and 1978, but obviously the end didn't happen. Lois becomes president. She claims that God showed her that the Holy Spirit is the feminine aspect of the Trinity. And later she gets a live-in relationship with this gentleman here named Vernon Howell. Vernon Howell becomes Seventh-day Adventist in 1979, and then joins the Branch Davidians in 1981. In 1983 is when he starts the live-in relationship with Lois Rodden and begins to take over the movement. 1986, Lois Rodden dies, leaving Vernon Howell to be there as the sole leader. Howell starts to introduce different things. He teaches he is entitled to have at least 140 wives. Later, 1989, he teaches what he called the New Light Doctrine, makes himself the rightful husband of every woman in the group, and the husbands and wives are all separated. In 1990, he changes his name to this, David Koresh. Do you know why his name was David Koresh? Why would you name yourself David Koresh? Get this. The word David from King David in the Bible. Okay, that's all right. Koresh, because that's the sound you make when you die. Whose skin just crawled? That's the name he chose for himself, David Koresh. David, King David, Koresh, the sound you make when you die. Well, 1993, the ATF raid the Branch Davidian compound in Texas. The attack causes the compound to explode, killing 86 people, 17 of which are children, which I'm not saying that's an okay thing. I had a person after I gave a talk once got really upset with me because he thought that I was endorsing what the government did there. I think the government made huge mistakes in what happened in Waco. But still, I think it's pretty clear to say David Koresh kind of abandoned the pacifist thing of Adventism. Because just stockpiling the weapons alone, whether he planned on using them or not, shows that he kind of got out of this. Now, there's still movements that follow even after this. After he's gone, this guy, Rinos Avram, he was part of the Branch Davidians during David Koresh's time. He went to prison from 1993 to 2006 because of the shootout. The exact name of his groups, I'm not sure. SevenSeals.org is his website. Also, I think it's Branch Davidian. Yeah, BranchDavidian.com is the website. So I'm going to call it Seven Seals because I don't know what else to call what it is. But he claims to be a prophet, the chosen vessel of the remaining bride and the successor of David Koresh. He once claimed that 1999 was going to be the end. That didn't happen. His next date, I love the precision that this man gives us. Now, it didn't happen, obviously, 2012, but August 6, 2012, at 12:07 p.m. I think it's Mountain Standard, I'm not sure. 12:07 p.m., a comet will punch through the Earth's atmosphere and over 20,000 miles per hour, and it will cause a massive earthquake. Okay, that was a year and a half. That's not going to happen. They have a new date. You go to their website now, March 10th, 2014. Less than 4 weeks, the end is going to happen, according to this gentleman. So don't file your taxes yet. Okay, wait until March 11th. We'll see. Okay? All right, let me clear some of this goop so we can see this remaining thing here. I didn't realize how much that top one looked like a pitchfork until I was making my... I don't mean it to do this. However, this last thing, I didn't know how to diagram this. This isn't necessarily a break off of Adventism. This isn't a splintering away, but a movement within, which you'll recognize where we're going with this. This gentleman, Donald Barnhouse, wrote some things about a book Ellen White wrote that wasn't very flattering, and some Adventists didn't like it too much. And so Donald Barnhouse asked this gentleman here, Walter Martin, to write a book about Seventh-day Adventism. In his research, Walter Martin met with some scholars in Seventh-day Adventist circles. And Donald Barnhouse later joined him for some of these meetings, as well as some other theologians. In this dialogue with Walter Martin, Donald Barnhouse, and these Seventh-day Adventist scholars, the evangelicals started to see Adventism in a different light. These scholars were presented in ways, their beliefs in ways that they didn't expect, and they started to soften in their position on Adventism. And the end in their conclusion, they said that Adventism is orthodox enough, I guess, is the kind of conclusion that they came up with. Well, they got a lot of evangelicals upset with them, but a lot of Adventists got upset with the Adventist theologians that were present in the meetings. After these meetings were over, the Seventh-day Adventist Church published a book called Questions and Doctrine, which went over a lot of the dialogues that happened between Walter Martin and the Seventh-day Adventist scholars. From this Questions on Doctrine, a lot of the Adventists saw this as a watering down of what they really believed. And so within Adventism, remember, this isn't a breakaway, but a movement within Adventism, people start going in different directions. I'll put three different modes here. There's the progressive Adventist, sometimes called liberal Adventism. They have their newspaper, The Adventist Today. Their reaction to Questions on Doctrine would be, and this is kind of a cartoonish version, but, well, I guess maybe a lot of these things don't really matter, so they can kind of come up with their new ideas or whatever. Richard Rice, if you know that name, Loma Linda, he's an open theist. He would fit into this category. He might even need his own category, perhaps, but still, he's the one that we could look at to maybe be along the streams of progressive Adventists. There's the evangelical Adventists. This would be the evangelical movement within Adventism. And in fact, I think Walter Martin said that only the Adventists who agree with questions on doctrines would be the ones who were orthodox enough. And those would be the ones that he would think of who we would call today the evangelical Adventists. But then there's the historic Adventists, sometimes called traditional or conservative Adventists. These are those that they saw questions on doctrine as an abomination. Like, that's not what we believe. They agreed with the older Adventism, you know, of what they're really, of sticking to Ellen White and the investigative judgment and all these things. They saw questions on doctrine as offensive, and they like the Adventism as before. Now, even though these movements are within Adventism, there are some breakoffs that didn't like what happened from this. One of these groups would be this one. What? We want two. Questions on doctrine. Okay, there it is. My slides got backwards. The Eternal Gospel Church, originally called the Eternal Gospel Seventh-day Adventist Church. I think, I'm not certain, but just from my read on it, they looked like they were so historic, they couldn't take it anymore, and in 1992, they broke off. In 1999, they took out a two-page ad in U.S. Today entitled, Earth's Final Warning. And they said, the Roman Catholic Church is the whore of Revelation, and the papacy instigated the observance of Sunday. Well, yeah, that's historic Adventism, isn't it? Well, Seventh-day Adventist Church, they got a little upset about this because everybody thought it was them. So they put a lawsuit against the Eternal Gospel Church, said that you can't use the name Seventh-day Adventist Church anymore because they don't want to be identified with this kind of movement. Well, this kind of gave some historic Adventists a little bit of a problem because they thought, well, wait a minute, we agree with what they said. Why don't you want to be identified with the truth of what they thought was the truth? So some groups got so historical, they broke off all the way. They're still operating. They changed their name because of the lawsuit, but it's interesting. This is from their website, Eternal Gospel Church, but still it throws underneath there, founded in 1992 by Seventh-day Adventist believers. I guess a lawsuit couldn't touch that they're saying this is where we came from. So they're not Seventh-day Adventists anymore. They used to be, and they broke off because Seventh-day Adventist Church lost their original vision. So this is the Sabbatarian Adventists. This is just a handful of them. There's more. There's more out there. I try to hit on what I thought are the interesting parts of the movement and also the big parts of the movement as well, some of the major groups that flowed from this. Looking at the picture as a whole, Mark Twain said, as we started, that a lie can be heard halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes. William Miller said, the end is coming, pack your bags. And everybody started this movement and jumped on board, and you can see how the lie traveled. Though they thought it was the truth, of course, it exploded from here. The lie is more fascinating than the truth in some ways. It moves faster. It goes faster. I remember talking to a guy who was in a cult. It wasn't an Adventist cult, but he had gotten out. He became a Christian. And I asked him, why did you join that group? What was it? He said, Tim, I don't know. It's like they had this special angle on truth, like the secret information that they're trying to tell the world. And he wanted to be part of it. I mean, this draw of we have a corner of the market. And it draws people in, and it sends them out like crazy. But I look at this, when I look at this diagram as a whole, I feel sad for everything that happened. William Miller was trying to do his best. He wasn't trying to start a cult. He wasn't trying to disrupt people's Christian lives. He thought this was going to happen. He kind of left the movement after the Albany Conference. But all of this stuff exploded and happened afterwards. So when I look at this and I feel sad, I think of this verse, 2 Corinthians 11:3. But I'm afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. So as the Eve was deceived, people get deceived, and they're drawn away from our sincere and pure devotion to Christ. some way the truth is impossible to believe, but it's so much easier. Jesus said, my yoke is light. Let's pray. Dear Father God, we thank you for your truth. We thank you that your yoke is light. We pray that you would help us remain true to you and not be fascinated by the ideas out there that would draw us away from you, because they are many. They're manifold. Father, help us hold unto you, to follow you, and to proclaim you, the real gospel of your Son, Jesus Christ, and your love for us. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.